So my phone decided to go off, and we just, I have no idea why, but it wanted to chime in.
Thank you so much, Tim's phone. We appreciate
it. Yeah, you
it.
Really wrecked this. Thanks a lot, phone. It thinks I want to bake salmon, which is the weirdest thing ever.
Oh, no.
I do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for December 2019. I am your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by old Saint Nick himself, Tim Nelson.
Yes.
Saint Nick, because Tim is a selfless, generous person who sort of looks like Santa Claus.
It's true. I was at work, and I had someone, this is a weird interaction I had with it, because I'm a chaplain, and I had a nurse tell me their kid was afraid of Santa Claus. So I said, well, your kid probably wouldn't like me then, because I look a little like a young Santa.
You do.
And then she said, no, you look much better than Santa.
Oh.
You're a better looking man than Santa.
Do we know what Santa looks like, or are we just going off the stereotypical commercial images?
I don't know.
Okay.
Apparently, he looks like an older version of me. And but then I felt real awkward because I didn't know how to take that, because is Santa a good, you're better looking than Santa.
Yeah.
Because Santa is a good, I mean, I wouldn't say he's good looking, but what I would say is he's highly revered.
Very much so. Yeah.
It's almost
everyone
like,
wants to hug Santa. So it's like,
it's like you're better looking than like Abe Lincoln or something.
Well, right.
a lot of people are, but I mean, I think that's one of those compliments. I didn't know where to put that.
You have to chew on that for a bit. And you're like, I don't know.
I'm like, are you hitting on me? I'm better looking than Santa, am I?
There you go.
And I don't know what that means.
But you do bear a resemblance. If your hair, all of your hair was white.
Shock white.
Yeah, shock white. You'd have it. You could do it.
I could do the belly. I could do the whole thing. I've been working on it too.
Awesome. Well,
the kids think I'm good.
So it's another holiday show, Tim. Last month we talked about our favorite Thanksgiving dish, right? And the movies we were thankful for. So how was your Thanksgiving? How did it all work out?
I worked 12-hour shift at the hospital.
Right. I forgot you were going to do that. That
and
sucks.
People told me that I was better looking than Santa.
Yeah, that happened then. Okay.
That happened.
Great.
Then. Yeah.
Well, mine was good. And check this out. I was over at my in-laws and I was eating the stuffing and I was like, what? Wait, this is it. This is the one I was talking about on the show. They've made it. And I realized what it was. It was not sausage in the stuffing, because I looked at my in-laws. I was like, I got this. I was just talking about this and what is in this. And they said, you were right, Tim. It's the giblets. They do the stuffing in the turkey with the giblets.
Oh, no.
No, it tasted so good. It's like the best stuffing I've ever had. And it was beautiful. It was there. So it's the one I was talking about last time. I ended up having it with total surprise. So.
I have like a traumatic experience of my grandpa feeding us that without us knowing what it was.
Uh-huh.
I'm like chewing on the heart of some bird.
Yeah.
And
if you think about it, it's kind of gross.
Yeah, like livers and stuff. And I'm like, this is really different. This is more bitter.
But it tastes good. Like the way they make it. I don't know. It honestly tastes like sausage to me, but maybe they just take the different parts of the bird that are like not.
It's possible
different.
That sausage and the giblets are very similar origins.
Yeah. So anyway.
So that was great. You figured it out. It wasn't sausage. It was organ meat.
Yeah, exactly.
And I appreciate that.
It was the bird heart. So now.
Can I tell you?
Okay.
So this is just for listeners out there who don't know that I'm a creep. This is a tradition I did for 3 years in a row with my brother when we were in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So every year my mom would prepare the turkey, and my job was to unwrap the turkey, wash the turkey, because I was a bigger guy, and it's hard for her to lift up the bird, right?
Yeah.
So I would be spraying the turkey, you know, cleaning it out, and I would pull out the heart and the lungs and all the neck and all that junk, right?
Yeah.
Whatever they put inside the bird. And so I would always, each year, I would take the heart out. I would wait till my brother took his shower on Thanksgiving Day, and I would go in there because I knew how to break into the bathroom. And while he was taking a shower, I would dump the turkey heart on his head.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, here's the best part. Yes, and it would freaking trip him out every year. He's like, there's little mini hearts falling into me in the shower.
That's so good.
Now,
gross.
The best part of all of this is that he would think he'd remember, right? But Thanksgiving is like 365.4 days away every year.
Yeah.
And he forgot for 2 years in a row that I would do this. And I would promise him, I said, I'm going to do this to you next year too.
Yeah.
And I did it for 3 years. So anyway, that was a Thanksgiving
tradition.
You think
you'd anticipate it. But it is. It's weird how a year goes by and you just, like, your brain forgets.
Our brains don't work real well.
I guess
that's
the moral of the philosophy is that, yeah, our brain doesn't. Brains are lazy.
So in, kids out there.
Yeah.
This is a new tradition of putting the organs of dead animals on your siblings.
Yeah.
The morning of Thanksgiving.
I love it.
I like it too.
A comedian I like said, Thanksgiving is the time where we eat this meat that we don't eat at any other time of the year because we all agree that it's just okay.
He's absolutely right.
That's exactly right. Anyway, so yeah, in a couple weeks, it's going to be Christmas, Tim. Christmas. You usually go out of town, right? You have like epic Monopoly games on Christmas.
Yeah, this year's
right?
A little sad because I've got to work on Christmas night.
On Christmas too? Tim, this is becoming depressing.
I know. I'm spending the night.
Uh-huh.
In the hospital in a little bed that everybody sleeps in, every chaplain.
Oh, no.
It's got like 15 people have slept in that bed or something, 20 people. And I'm going to spend the night in the little bed. And if somebody has a chaplain need, I will be at the hospital.
Dude, I think our listeners are starting to get concerned. Like, when do you get to enjoy one of these holidays? Are you just like taking your lumps now and maybe next year you'll be able to?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
because
okay.
I know you're new
to it. It's a 1 year deal. Yeah. I'm in a residency. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we take the horrible shifts other people don't have to.
Man, well, that's good. I mean, it's very selfless of you. I mean, there's people that need your help on Christmas. It never takes a day off. So that is really great that you're going to be there. I would want you there if I was in the hospital on Christmas.
That's right, man. Yes. Never takes a day off.
That's right.
Disease and death and...
Right, I know.
They never get an off day, John, you see. So I'm there to...
You're there.
I don't know what I do to those things. I think I just am there for those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm going out of town. I'm going home for the holidays, actually. My old stomping ground, Grand Rapids. So, seeing my mom. We're going there for a week in my mom's house. I'm going to regret that like 2 days in. But
Don't say that. She
no, I'm kidding.
She listens.
I love my mom. My mom is the reason this podcast exists. She's the one who got me into movies. I love my mom. But, you know, you're at the in-laws. And you, especially when you got the kids and they're running around and everyone's kind of going crazy.
And there's two sets of rules.
Yeah.
There's like your house rules. And then there's some kind of international law.
Uh-huh.
Like sea nautical law, maybe something. Mm-hmm. Of child raising.
Totally.
And you're unfamiliar with it. Your children don't know it either.
Yeah.
But as soon as they figure out the loopholes, they exploit them.
Yeah, right away. Yeah, it's very, it happens
very
quickly.
Where did you get that candy from?
Well, grandma said it's like, yeah, it's fun, but it's going to be great. I love coming home for the holidays. So I'm excited about that. And look, I'm not going to bother asking what our favorite Christmas movie is because we've talked about it before and we both agree that it is, of course, It's a Wonderful Life. Right? We both agree. This is the perennial Christmas movie.
I like it.
Yeah. So we've already done that. So we're not going to rehash it. But what I do want to do is I want to take the time, Tim, to defend It's a Wonderful Life because there's a wonderful woman we both know, and her name is Megan Westra.
She hates it?
Megan is an extraordinary human being who I've known for 6 years, I think. You've known her for longer, right?
Yeah.
She's great. She is a kind, extraordinary woman who does amazing work in the city, and she even wrote a book. Did you know she's coming out with a book?
She said that to me this summer. I don't know about it yet, though, but I want to hear about it.
It is called Born Again and Again, Jesus' Call to Radical Transformation. Everyone listening to this show should go pre-order it now. I've heard what this is about, and it's going to blow you away. Born Again and Again, Jesus' Call to Radical Transformation by Megan Westra. Get that on Amazon. It's going to be great. But
again and again.
Having said all that, no one's perfect, right? We've all got flaws. I think Megan would be the first to admit that she might have some.
So what did she do, John?
She tweeted something, Tim, and I'm going to quote it here. She said,
Are we starting a war, John?
On Twitter.
I didn't start this war, Megan.
She said, It's a Wonderful Life is a terrible movie. That was the tweet. And maybe if that had been all, that would have been okay. But then the comments started in Twitter. Not Megan, but other people.
Are you being drawn into some kind of war?
Yeah, and the comments started on Twitter. And I won't name the commenters, but one commenter said about It's a Wonderful Life, it was a box office flop in 1945.
That's true.
And it's really only popular because they forgot to renew the copyright, and it entered into the public domain in 1974, and TV stations could show it for free. So they did, and that basically tricked us all into believing that it was a Christmas classic.
Ah.
Do you agree with that take?
Well, I think you got to take the film for what the film is.
Yeah. I just don't get the theory that if something is played enough that suddenly we're brainwashed into thinking that it's a classic. I think that it's legitimately...
Like Christmas of the Cranks? That gets played like every 10 minutes.
No one thinks that's a great movie, right?
You could start a movie at like 6:20. Yeah, it's a horrible movie.
Right.
But it gets played constantly and it hasn't turned into like a classic. It's turned into obnoxious.
Exactly. I watched It's a Wonderful Life like for the first time like 6 years ago and I was... consider myself a discerning critic at that point, and I loved it. I fell in love with it right away because it's a great movie. So I just don't buy it.
Do you want me to tell like why it's great? It's just what
you're asking. Why do you love It's a Wonderful Life?
Because it's a modern day Christmas Carol.
Yes,
and it's told reverse.
Mm, I never even thought about that. That's so good.
Yeah, it's like a good man who can't see any value in his life. And he's taken by an angel, not a ghost,
yes,
to go look at his life. Versus a Scrooge tale, which is a very evil man is taken to look at his life so that he can see what he's done and how he's like basically wrecked everything. But It's a Wonderful Life is kind of like a reverse of that and saying, no, look what you've done. All your actions add up to something. All the small decisions and the ways you've honored people add up to something, even if you don't feel that.
Mm.
So to me, it's like a very encouraging, very encouraging message.
Yes, yeah. I agree. It's life affirming. Every single time I watch it, I get tears in my eyes at the end because it just reminds me of what's important in life.
It's about giving home loans to immigrants.
Yeah, it's very politically relevant. No, it is.
But Capra himself is pretty conservative.
Yeah. There's a good article on our website. One of our writers reviewed It's a Wonderful Life and brought up the political dimensions of it. But another commenter on this thread said, and this is the last one I will quote, it's literally about a man who's okay as long as things are good, then falls into a complete spiral when things go awry and has a major pity party while his wife goes and gets crap done and saves everything. It's a hot take. I just don't see it, man. Because to me, the whole movie is building up to that moment where George Bailey loses it, right? It's not like we meet him for 15 minutes.
Trolling this movie. You can do that to anything, that critique.
Exactly. Wow. It's not like we meet him for 15 minutes and everything's fine and then suddenly he goes wrong and is all suicidal. Like the whole movie spends like an hour showing you this whole man's life and how he has sacrificed again and again, constantly passing up legitimate opportunities that by worldly standards are like, you should go do that, right? And then he gets to this point after that long journey where suddenly he's facing like jail time over this missing money, his house, which he sacrificed for, is falling apart. His kids are obnoxious, right? Join the club, George. And the dude has a moment of crisis. It's a human moment, but the whole movie's been building up to it. So I don't get that.
It's a hard disagree. Aren't there other things to like be hating?
Yeah. Stop hating on the Christmas classics.
Well, I just don't know what the I'm trying to identify the hatred I can feel for that movie, and I can't find it very well.
Exactly.
I'm like, hey, George Bailey saved somebody's life, and because they were about to.
He did. He saved the angel's life.
Well, right? No, he saves a lot of lives. He's in the pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
His son gets killed in the war, and he does a bad prescription because he's emotionally distraught, and George catches it, and he does it in a way that's really sensitive to the dignity of that person. He gets home loans for folks. He fights the evil capitalists who have monopolies and who want to oppress people. I'm like, who hates this movie?
I know. That's what was so shocking to me too. But there you go. We defended It's a Wonderful Life. Megan, you'll always have my respect. I love you. I hope you sell lots of books because you deserve it. And the book, again, is Born Again and Again. Jesus is Called the Radical Transformation. Pre-order now. But Megan, It's a Wonderful Life is one of the best movies of all time, and you are wrong.
Don't write a book about this movie because you're wrong about it.
Yes. We love you, Megan. All right. So, Tim, it's time to get down to business. We have a lot to talk about. Because when you think about Christmas movies, I think one of the first names that always comes to mind is Martin Scorsese.
What?
Just kidding. That never happens. We are talking about a Martin Scorsese movie today because it is not only the Christmas season, it is, of course, Oscar season, and that means that great movies are flooding our theaters, and we have to talk about them. So we are going to talk today about The Irishman. That is Martin Scorsese's latest movie. The Irishman recently up for 5 Golden Globes, including Best Picture, best director, best screenplay, best supporting actor, and best actor.
The foreign press are troublemakers. Is that what a Golden Globe is?
But always a precursor to the Oscars in most cases. So The Irishman is sure to be a major Oscar contender, and we're going to talk about it. So here we go, man. Here we go.
Boom.
So let's talk about Netflix, Tim. Finally, we can actually say that a movie we're reviewing is on Netflix. We've made a mistake in the past and thought that it was going to be, and it wasn't. But it's on there. It's on Netflix, and you can go watch it right now, listeners. In fact, we encourage you to stop the show. Go watch The Irishman. It's only 3.5 hours
long. Unless you really hate profanity.
And violence.
Incredible violence.
Right.
Yeah, homicidal maniacs on screen for 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Unless that's you, which I don't quite understand. But yeah, then go stop the show and watch this 3.5 hour long movie. Or if you don't like really long movies, that would be another one. But go watch it and then come back and talk about it. So because we're going to let the spoilers, we're going to be looser with the spoilers than normal because you've got no excuse. It's right there. Everyone has a Netflix subscription. Go watch The Irishman and come back and we'll talk about it. So, but I want to talk about Netflix because I have to say, watching a huge Oscar contender from the comfort of my couch on a laptop was an amazing experience. Because I've talked about it before where I get kind of burned out about this time, you know, where I've got to go see all these movies in the theaters. I am fine with the trend of Oscar movies being there for the taking with press and play. What do you think?
No.
Are you on board? No. Okay.
No.
Okay. Go for it. Why don't you like it?
Because you should, they're not in the format they were made to be seen in. And it's that simple. And it's why I can't, I struggle with Netflix.
Okay.
Because first off, if this film, I would have been happy to pay my $8 to $12 to see.
Yeah.
I would have.
Yeah, me too.
And when I'm so lazy that I would never actually go do that because I'd be like, oh, I could watch it on a 40-inch screen, you know? And what happens is we miss a lot of the cinematography, we miss the force that the director is trying to communicate when it comes in the smaller format. And then also it means that we're talking about different things. Like if this is another issue with film, right? Because I saw Roma small screen, you saw Roma big screen.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And what we ended up having was we saw two different movies.
Yeah.
And so I'm hesitant to have the small screen be, especially the director that's so visual. Mm-hmm. To have the small screen have it be so easy.
Right. Did you watch it all in one setting?
Yeah. No, I watched it in two settings.
Okay. So that's the other problem, especially with a movie this long. Yeah.
Yeah. You could go like, I gotta go get some peanut butter. And then the motion of a moment might like fall.
You know, that's true. I had to stop it a couple times to go get food because I started it like too late. It's like 10:30 or something. And so, yeah, I had to go get some food. And then you're stepping out of that movie. Whereas in the theater, you're just kind of, you have to stay in it. Stay in that headspace.
At least have the intermission. I get why theaters would be hesitant. And my guess is also like with the Netflix format, you can go long and not have some studio breathing down your neck.
Right. Right. And, you know, Scorsese claims, he wrote a big long article where he basically admitted that the Netflix was one of the only places that would actually distribute the movie, right? And he basically, to him, that is a sign that studios are missing the mark, right? He kind of brought up Marvel movies and he said, you know, there's all these big budget movies, which are fine. He was careful to say they're well made, but that they're kind of crowding over the multiplexes and small independent movies like this are getting crowded out and sourced to Netflix. And while he was grateful that Netflix provided the distribution, he was sad because he feels like these...
How small independent? This thing had a $160 million budget.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
And it had Scorsese as a director. How small and independent is this?
Right. Well, but one of the major counterpoints I would have is what you just said is like maybe studios aren't too keen on releasing a 3.5 hour mob movie into theaters, right? I mean, like there is a point where maybe it's just this film and not like all films. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's not accessible to, I guess you do get a different market when you're doing it via Netflix.
Right. And plus, I always struggle with this whole idea. Like, there's always this kind of older director that comes out and says, oh, they're just all the movies these days, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, there has always been big event movies ever since I was a kid, right? Like, you think back to, like, Will Smith and freaking Wild Wild West came out when I was, like, 14. You want to talk about...
John, if you want to take that back, you can go back and... this is why I love the podcast format.
Yeah.
Because I think you went to a movie I wouldn't have mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to talk about it. And
no, I know. But that's my point, is that that is the biggest, dumbest, most awful movie.
It's an awful movie.
Awful movie. And it made a ton of money, and it was a big summer event film. So now you got Martin Scorsese coming along in 2019 saying, oh, there's all these big movies coming out that are, it's like, there's always been big dumb movies. And I want to say that I don't even think the Avengers belongs in the same breath as something like Wild Wild West. We're talking about Marvel movies are like artistic big budget movies that put movies like that to shame.
So do you think, because you got a few points here, let's look at the last one you made.
Yeah,
I could still go back right now and watch the movie Casino.
Mm-hmm.
And it holds up. Like, it's a great film still.
Yeah, sure.
Now, if I take something that's a similar era Marvel movie, not the new Marvel movies, but just a movie from the same era that's a superhero movie.
Okay.
It's awful. Absolutely terrible.
Like maybe old school Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire or something like that.
Horrible.
Yeah.
And so I think that, I don't know. Do you think the Marvel movies are going to really hold up over time?
Yes, I do. I think that that legitimately quality artistic movies. I really do. And I think they're going to hold up. Yeah. Unless if they're not, then I'm just completely like been brainwashed or something. But because like to me, they're really good. They're well constructed, well made movies. I don't know. You don't think so? You think we're going to look back
I'm
and
not
be like,
saying they're
oh,
bad
what
movies?
Happened?
I just think that they're very much zeitgeist movies. It's like your iPhone, though. There might be a different version every few years.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll always be, oh, this is the best version of this I've ever seen.
I get what you're saying. Using the Spider-Man example, like we go back now and we look at that. Back at the time, that was like the peak. Like that was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I remember seeing Spider-Man 2 and it was like amazing. But now compared to what we have going on, it's like, there's some, so maybe in 10 years we'll look back and say comparatively.
Or like look at the Lucas. All right. So remember when they redid the Star Wars in the late 90s?
Yes.
And then that was a mess because now you have, look at it now.
Oh, yeah.
So 20 years later or whatever.
That Jabba the Hutt scene in A New Hope that they added looks terrible.
Right. So now it has to get redone and redone and redone. Now imagine that's a whole movie because that's what these Marvel movies are. They're whole movies of that.
Uh-huh.
So to me, it's like they reflect our current culture and our current technology versus a movie like Casino is, I don't think it doesn't do that
because
all you have is people in a casino.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
and it's timeless.
Desert. Yeah.
And that's a fair point. But let's, what about the point that there aren't, that smaller movies, more independent flair movies are getting pushed out? I don't see that happening because I feel like every time we get around Oscar season, any movie that's up for the major awards gets into theaters and it makes a decent amount of money. Like, I don't see how that's happening.
So I think what you have here is, this is my opinion on this, and I could be totally wrong. I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
Because most of my opinions are just radical guesses. I'm throwing something into the pitch black. But
you make it sound convincing every time.
It sounds convincing every time. I might convince myself.
Yeah.
So his last film that was about the priests.
Yeah, the Silence.
Silence bombed.
Did it really? It didn't make a lot of money?
I'm pretty sure it bombed.
Okay.
But it was, to me, a really great movie.
Mm-hmm. It was okay. I struggled with a little bit, but yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
But I mean, it's like profound themes.
Yeah.
Like,
it's definitely worth watching.
But you make a mobster movie with a lot of F words and like whacking people.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure there's lots of tension.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, people love that.
Yeah.
You know.
So what's your point?
So my point is this. He had a bomb. And I think that is true. Even a Scorsese.
Like a little bitterness maybe.
Well,
he's
had other bombs too, like Bringing Out the Dead, which I think that's an incredible movie, but nobody liked it.
Nicolas Cage, right.
Yeah. And so, Cage, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So I think that's an incredibly theological movie. So is Silence.
Mm-hmm.
And those movies are very heady. Both of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's only as good as kind of his last film because still somebody has to, you know, drop 160 million, 200 million, 300 million into whatever project he's got.
Right.
So if he is basically pissing money out the window, which is what he did with Silence, I believe, then why should any studio support him with more money? That's the reality.
Right.
So even if you look at who produced this, who was it? Him and De Niro. I mean, it's like everybody's in the film that's producing it.
Uh-huh.
It's like, so you and I should go make a film in the backyard and I'll buy the pizza. You know?
So the theory is that if your last movie had problems and it didn't make a lot of money for the studio, then you're going around to have all these meetings and suddenly the studio heads are kind of all up in your face it's easy to think that the whole system has kind of become jaded against you, which in reality, maybe it's not.
Right. I don't know if the system is the problem here. It might be that your movie didn't make any money last time.
Right.
And if the studio system is based on, as you would guess, making more money than you spend.
Yeah.
Then I think, of course, he's having a distribution issue.
Right. Right. And I don't know. I would like to find out if Silence actually did lose money. I didn't hear that. But if it did, then yeah. And then your next proposal is a 3.5-hour mob movie. It's like, okay, at some point, someone's like, dude. Yeah.
Yeah, it lost half its budget.
Oh,
so
there you go.
Basically, this is just Wikipedia, so Lord have mercy on me. But basically, the budget was not that high. It was 40 to 50 million.
Uh-huh.
So it was like a third of this one.
Yeah.
But it only took in 23 million.
Dang. I mean, yeah.
So he's like, oh no, I'm not getting my distribution. Right. Yeah, because you freaking peed away $24 million last run.
Shoot. Right, right.
Think about that, man. What if you lost $24 million at work? I don't think you'd have another job or be complaining about not having another job.
I would not.
Yeah, I kind of wrecked that.
Right. Whereas, to contrast, I just saw a kind of an indie movie called Jojo Rabbit, which was so good. It made me cry. Literally, I felt so good at the end of it that I started crying. It was such a good movie. You guys should see Jojo Rabbit. It's so good. But anyway, that's an indie, off-kilter, kind of absurdist comedy, not mainstream at all. It had Fox Searchlight put it in theaters. It grossed $20 million, and it only cost $14 million to make. So there you go. You got a profit. I think you're totally right. I think there are always going to be smaller movies making it into theaters, but you got to make money. And sorry, Scorsese, you know? I don't know what to tell you, man. Anyway.
Oh.
Yeah.
I forgot to tell you, my wife met Scorsese.
Really? In California? Because yes. You guys live there.
So they were scouting or prepping a location, and he wanted to see, because I think it was, did he have something to do with The Aviator maybe? I can't remember.
He directed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Leo.
Yeah, so it was for The Aviator.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's law school is Deco, which is the time period that the Hughes movie set in, well, parts of it.
Nice.
And so she opens the door for this guy that has like an entourage as she's walking into her law school, like right through the front door. She opens the door. She sees this guy, and she sees the fellow law student like jaw drop. And she says hi to him. Oh, yeah, here, come on in. Okay. And he's like, thank you, when she opens the door, when she closes the door. And the guy goes, do you know who you just opened the door for? And it was Martin Scorsese scouting her law school. That was a former Wilshire Bullocks department store.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So she like held the door, didn't have any idea who he was. But he's very distinctive looking, especially the glasses.
Right. For sure. Yeah.
So she didn't really meet him, but she held the door for him once.
What a story. Your wife held the door open for Martin Scorsese. There you go, man. That's a good story.
It was the closest we ever got to Martin Scorsese.
I love it.
Till tonight.
I hope he's listening. So... well, let's talk about him. Let's dive in. So what's your experience with Scorsese? When you hear the name, what immediately comes to mind?
Well, I hold the door for Scorsese sometimes. Well, it's actually my wife that holds the door once in a while. Okay, one time.
Right.
But beyond that,
yeah.
Raging Bull, right?
Raging Bull, yeah.
What else? Gangs of New York,
mm-hmm.
Taxi Driver.
And mob movies, of course. Like, that's his signature.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Goodfellas.
He loves mob movies. There's always a debate about which is better, Goodfellas or The Godfather. Where do you fall on that?
Oh, Godfather for sure.
Goodfellas for sure.
What?
100%. Goodfellas.
Have you seen? Hold on a sec. Have you seen The Godfather, John?
Of course. 100%.
Think Goodfellas is a better movie than Godfather?
Goodfellas covers all the same ground as The Godfather, but in a smaller, tighter, more stylish package.
You're so wrong about all that. I can't believe you feel that way.
I deserve this because we just ragged on Megan. All right, this is my unpopular take, because it probably is very unpopular.
Yes. It's okay. It's absolutely unpopular with everyone.
Uh-huh. I totally disagree. I love The Godfather. It's in my top 10. I love it, you know, but I think The Goodfellas is doing the same thing, but it's way more enjoyable to watch. Now, there are different movies. I know The Godfather is going for a more operatic, Shakespearean type thing, and The Goodfellas is a little more, you know, fast and punchy, but...
I think Goodfellas is like Boogie Nights. and you like it because of the similarities.
Yeah.
I think it has that P.T. Anderson feel.
Definitely.
And I think because of that, I think that's a style that you like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a better movie, but I could see why you like it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So,
and I like it too. I just don't, yeah. I just don't have some kind of neurotic condition like you who thinks Goodfellas is better than The Godfather.
I don't think I'm the only one who has that opinion, but maybe I am. Gosh, maybe I am.
It's okay, man.
Yeah, thank you.
It's okay. But you know what? You get the right counselor, we can sort this thing out.
All right. Hey, let's talk about mob movies. Why are they so fascinating? Scorsese loves them, right? But honestly, like, I think everyone just kind of loves mob movies. There's something that's captivating about them. What do you think it is that makes them just always interesting?
Power.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
It's the idea that there's a secret power that's under the surface of everything.
Yeah.
And if you were in that network of power, if you're willing to get your hands dirty,
mm-hmm.
you could have the power. You could have that power too, maybe.
Right. And it's how that power gets flipped, right? Because on one hand, if you're in the mob, you're totally connected. No one can touch you. Someone touches you, they die, right? But on the other hand, you can also say a bad joke to someone and you could be dead that night, right? Yeah,
it depends who you are, right? In the power structure.
Yeah. And that's fascinating.
I think so. And then there's also, but within that mob structure, there's also a code of honor among like these folks who are like dishonorable.
Yeah.
So I think that's always, yeah. And I also think within a, you know, we don't have this, I think you nailed it with a Shakespearean kind of idea,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think the mob and the whole idea of like a godfather is more similar to a king than anything that we have in our culture.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that kind of Shakespearean drama can play out that way, where you have someone who on a whim could take you out, but also on a whim could make you something.
Yeah. That's why Game of Thrones is so popular. There's something about that that's always appealing, right?
Yeah. So I think that has that this idea within it. And then because, and then mafia is also very much your identity, your tribe identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it could be different. Even this film's like The Irishman. How'd this Irishman make it so far in the mob, right? Oh, yeah. He was a hitman or whatever. But the idea that your ethnic identity would play into how far you could get somewhere.
And there's something about those like quick, sudden bursts of violence that's always in these mob movies, right? Where like at any moment you can get that pop, pop, pop and you're dead. And it's always like your best friend doing it to you, right? It's that person that you'd be like, hey, and then your life is over. There's something morbidly fascinating about that. Yeah.
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 So power.
Yeah. Right. Yep. So how do you think, like we could spend hours talking about how The Irishman compares to like all of Martin Scorsese's filmography, but where do you think it stacks up to like just other of Scorsese's mob movies, just his mob movies? So we're talking like Casino, The Departed, you know, Mean Streets. Where do you think it fits on that sort of tier?
I haven't thought about that yet. What do you think?
I think it's better than Casino. I think it's better than The Departed. I haven't seen Mean Streets, which I know is terrible and blasphemous because I should have seen it by now. You've seen it, right? Yeah. I've heard it's really good, but I do think it's in the top tier. I don't think it's as good as Goodfellas, as I've said. I think
I can agree with that for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Goodfellas is the best one that he's made.
That he's made, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I feel like it's just that when you're comparing it to like something like Goodfellas, it's a little... Irishman is a little too long. And it lacks some of the big flourishes.
So another mob movie that he made is Gangs of New York.
Right. That's true. And I forget about that because that is the Irish mob.
Basically, yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis, right? Leonardo DiCaprio. That is a really good movie. Yeah, for sure.
Who can run the 5 points? That's like basically the same idea, power.
Yep.
Is it going to be immigrants or is it going to be the native born?
Uh-huh.
And that's a political thing too.
I think the best shot of Gangs of New York is the last shot at the end where like they do the time capsule of the city and it goes to modern day. I think that's the best moment in the movie.
Cool. What's that saying? Is it saying it's still the same as
exactly?
It was?
I yeah. think that's the point. Yeah. So was there anything about Scorsese's directing that stood out to you in this particular film?
I just thought like all the period stuff got nailed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so like everything seems like it is. I just have all these like images of when I was a kid and there were these old guys who were in their 60s and 70s and they behaved like these old guys. And because I'm from the 80s, you know, I remember these old types.
Yeah.
they kind of nailed it.
Yeah.
Everything about it. They did a good, he did a great job on it. Cause this is a film, and this is something that struck me. There's not a lot of young people in this film, and that is not something that we're used to.
That's a good point. Yeah.
We're used to seeing everybody be 26 in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in this film, everybody is like 76.
Right.
And so it's a little jarring because of that, because of the age of everyone's senior citizen.
And it's not a joke. It's not like Space Cowboys, you know, in Clinton.
No, it's not like, yeah, it's not Space Cowboys or Wild Hogs or any of these silly movies about, you know, aging men finding themselves or having one last rocket ship or whatever they do. I don't know what this is. But no, this is like, it's very serious.
Yep.
It's like, no, this is. And so that was something I liked about it, because we don't see a lot of movies about people who are older, you know, and that's where we start out in this film. As far as like the technical aspects of the film, it's hard for me to gauge because, like I said, I watched it on a 40-inch screen.
Yeah.
And so we're talking, you know, how do we talk about that? I'm like, I can't even compare it to like, I can't say a lot about it because it wasn't seen how it was supposed to be seen.
Yeah, no, it's fair. I do think I always love the way he uses music. I think it's incredible the way he always has that perfect synergy of music with film, and the music keeps the story flowing. Like he brings music into every scene, and even the most mundane scenes just keep being propelled forward by his choice of music. And I think that's a key to, it was key to Goodfellas, and it's a key to The Irishman too. And there's a little stylistic flourishes. Like in Goodfellas, you had multiple perspectives on the voiceover. In this one, you have, in that opening scene, you have your standard voiceover, and then it morphs into actually seeing Robert De Niro, and then he kind of takes over the voiceover. So there's little things that he does that keeps things fresh, and I think he's just always a really interesting filmmaker.
That was a great first scene.
Yeah.
And it goes into the whole idea. So like the first scene and the last scene are nursing home scenes.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of... The idea of the nursing home is that you're powerless.
Yeah. And we just talked about power is what...
Right.
Yeah.
And so the nursing home scene is, this is the place where when people don't have the power they used to, this is where they go. And then every, you know, even Jesus talks about when you're old, someone will lead you where you don't want to go, right?
Yeah.
That's what we have here, is we have this place where everyone is dependent on someone to do basic, to provide for their very basic needs.
Hmm.
So instead of entering the film with some very powerful scene, right, where somebody's hitting somebody with a baseball bat or whatever, it's a powerless scene. Mm-hmm. So we kind of start out powerless, and then the last one's powerless too.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something to that.
That's the bookends of the movie, and it really points to the thematic weight of it, yeah.
And if you're looking at someone who's at the end of their life, like Scorsese, De Niro, Pacino, Pesci, they're all at the end of their... They're not at the end of their life, but they're not too far.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain appreciation of that their potency and their power is behind them. And so maybe this take is a take about like, what is it when your power is gone? What is that? How do you reflect upon that power?
And it's so fitting because all of the major actors of Scorsese's career shows up in this, and it does feel, you know, I hope Scorsese goes on to make a ton more movies, but it does kind of feel like like the most perfect bookend to his career that you could ever ask for. Just everyone's here, and they're all in it for kind of one last hurrah. Yeah. Let's talk about the acting. This is such a good cast. You got Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, Harvey Keitel. There's like all these actors that Scorsese has been with from the beginning. So I mean, we could spend hours going through all their filmographies, but let's just keep it to this movie. We'll start with Al Pacino. I love Al Pacino when he's in yelly mode. I think he's...
absolutely.
He's just like, there's something about... Like, it reminds me of Glengarry Glen Ross, which is such a great movie, and like him in particular, just where he just like owns the room and he's chewing everyone out, you know, and spitting them up. And there's so many moments in The Irishman where he has that quality where he... Like one of my favorite scenes is when he's in his office and he's like calling everyone in the room like a mother effer or whatever, and then Robert De Niro just leaves and he goes and runs out and he's
What's
like,
wrong,
well, I didn't mean you, and he's like, well, you should tell me that.
That was great. Yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah,
but also there's that's a show. And he's doing it for effect.
And you see that, right? Right, exactly.
The Hoffa character.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I didn't know much about Jimmy Hoffa, which shows how historically illiterate I am.
That was the point. You don't even know who Hoffa is.
Oh, really? So he's not... Nurse.
No, no, he's real.
Oh, yeah, no, he's real, but he's not like a major...
No, he's a major character. Okay. He's a major player because he's the head of the Teamsters.
Okay, so did you know a lot about him?
I didn't know. I mean, I don't know what I know that he disappeared. I know that he was connected to the mafia, and I know he's very powerful.
Okay, that's way more than I knew.
And that he was pissing away the pension funds. So I knew that, and that he had testified.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. So, yeah, Al Pacino, man, is just a perfect character for him. I feel like he was born to play him. He's got that energetic, kind of arrogant, owns the whole world, doesn't know when to shut up. And, yeah, it's great. Pacino was great in this. Do you like him?
Yeah, I did. I don't know if he reminded me of Hoffa, but I think he found a way to kind of accomplish what needed to be accomplished.
Yeah, which is all I ever ask for when you're embodying a real character. Just find the essence, you know?
He reminded me of Pacino, which is fine, mm-hmm. but I think he comes off as he accomplishes what he needs to accomplish for the character in the film.
Yeah. So Robert De Niro is Frank Sheeran. Now, we didn't really talk about the plot much yet, but to kind of sum it up for those who did not follow our directions and watch the movie yet, De Niro basically plays a middleman in the mob, and he works for Joe Pesci's character, which we'll talk about in a second. But Pesci's like the big mob boss, and he runs everything, and De Niro's sort of the middleman. He has some power, but mostly does what he's told, and he is assigned to be kind of Jimmy Hoffa's right-hand guy. He's like his protection, but he's also kind of his go-between between the mob and Jimmy Hoffa, and he becomes Hoffa's really close friend, which is actually what propels a lot of the conflict, because the mob starts becoming angry at Hoffa and you've got De Niro sort of in the middle as the go-between. Yeah.
Right.
So what do you think of De Niro? Because I didn't love his performance, but I want to hear what you think first.
He's just so old that it's hard. Like, there's a scene where he's like kicking the crap out of like the grocer.
Yeah.
And it looks like...
It looks awkward.
Yeah. And I was like, and I don't know. I was like, man... Get a stunt double in there, because he looks like he's gonna hurt himself.
I thought the same thing.
As he's like beating someone up, he looks like he's gonna hurt himself.
I didn't buy it at all. I'm like, you're gonna fall over. Yeah.
Yeah. It looked terrible. It looked fake. I've never. That was very clear. It looked like someone who couldn't move was beating somebody up.
Yeah.
And he looked 80 years old in that.
And he's just kind of a blank slate, like facial expression, just the whole thing. Like, I know that's partly his character, but for 3.5 hours watching like a blank slate, it's like a little bit,
I think there's flavors of sociopath in him. Mm-hmm. And I think he does a good job there, because you can't be a hitman. And they get into the backstory that he's in the war, and that's where he becomes he begins that kind of journey. I don't know if you become a sociopath or you just are one, but he's able to kill and not feel remorse about it. He just does it. Mm-hmm. And it's even comes up with confession and all that.
Yeah, totally. So you're not going to have like this big emotional scene where he just like loses it. I get that.
I think what defines him is that he can divorce himself from his feelings and get the job done and do the thing. Now, that's a different scene with his daughter. He shows absolute emotion. He does.
That's a good point.
The contrast is when he does a hit, he gets out of there as fast as he can. He wants no one to see. But when someone hurts his daughter, he goes in and he makes a spectacle of it.
Yes.
And so it's a very different thing than a hit for him.
I like
that. So killing people is like nothing, but it doesn't matter. I mean, he just does it the way that he's not going to get caught. But with his daughter, the idea is like, you know, it's personal and he has emotion attached to it.
And it's right in the middle of the city where everyone could see it.
Yeah. And it's super embarrassing to her.
Yeah.
And it makes her afraid of him.
For life.
Yeah. And never trust him.
Yep.
And so that's what got accomplished that's what you're seeing, because this is so masterfully done.
Yep.
Not by the act. And I don't know if it's so much by the acting, but it's getting done by the story.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I don't want to portray Robert De Niro as bad as an actor in this at all. I could think he's great. I just felt like the character itself, it was a little platonic for kind of being stuck with him for 3.5 hours, but it totally is his character. I get that. And that's a really good point about, you do see that those flashes of emotion when it comes to his daughter and for sure.
So the idea is like the person that he's supposed to be protecting and caring for and all this other stuff, he's just damaging.
Yeah.
And then the person but he's also the person that's supposed to attack Hoffa.
Right. Yeah. But dude, what was with his bright blue eyes. It looked so bad. They look so fake. Did you notice this?
I'm colorblind, so I don't know.
It was so distracting to me. They like CGI'd Robert De Niro's eyes to be bright blue, and he's normally brown eyes. He's got brown eyes, right? But I think because he's supposed to be an Irishman, like they gave him blue.
Can't they just find an Irishman?
Who cares? It doesn't matter. There is no one that would watch this movie and go, it was good, but Robert De Niro, brown eyes? You kidding me? No one would say that. He's Robert De Niro. It doesn't matter. But they instead included this terrible effect where it is so painful to watch. It's so bad. I can't believe they released a movie with it looking that bad. I'm sorry that you didn't get to see it because you're kind of colorblind, but man, it does not look natural at all.
I'm sorry.
Anyway.
I'm sorry that was traumatic for you.
But the true standout of the movie for me was definitely Joe Pesci as the mob boss, Russell. What I loved was how understated Pesci was in this. And I know I just got done saying that I was kind of disappointed that De Niro didn't do enough, but there's something about the understatement of Pesci that's different. There's a power to his quietness that has its own energy to it. It's really good. It's really tangible. I think he's fantastic in this movie. What did you think?
No, it's no Home Alone.
No. Nice. It's that time of the year.
I'm sorry. Yeah. No, it's no, I think Pesci is excellent. I know he's retired.
Yeah. It took a lot of work to get him to do this. Yeah.
Did it? Mm-hmm. I don't know the background on that, but yep. I don't know any roles I don't like Pesci in.
That's true.
I think I like him in everything.
It's a good point. My Cousin Vinny, going back.
Yeah. Even that's a great movie.
It is.
I mean, I can't complain about that. Yeah. He seems to be able to play whatever he needs to play.
So what did you think about his character in particular?
I thought it was a complex performance, kind of tortured, mm-hmm. but also he was really a company man in some ways.
Hmm. Yeah.
In this, and able to he was kind of like, well, here's the code and I go by the code and kind of this is how this works.
Yep.
And so I think he was a very strong character.
Yeah. And then there's so many other good actors in this. I mean, Ray Romano's in it. I thought Ray Romano's doing this delve into serious roles nowadays. And I think it works. I liked him in this. And he was also really good in another Netflix movie called Paddleton, which was really good.
Oh, yeah. I remember Paddleton.
It was
I
good.
Saw that.
Yeah. So he's been doing serious roles lately. And I think he's fantastic. So I don't know.
He's got a nervous energy to him.
Yeah.
That in that voice, it's kind of,
that's good.
That is it's kind of you need that contrast. It's like the acid to the fat, what I mean?
Yes.
And you need the contrast between these smooth power talking,
yeah,
very kind of vicious dialogue, and then you have
yeah,
and it kind of that contrast works in this film.
It does. And Harvey Keitel, and yeah, it's a wonderful cast, and everyone plays their roles really well. So
can I complain?
Sure.
This is something I have to say about it. I am tired of seeing violence juxtaposed to sacraments. That is a tired, just super tired thing to do in a mafia movie.
Well, it goes back to the end of The Godfather, where
the christening.
The christening, yeah.
But that is tired. It's no longer, to me, that's lazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, because it's beyond cliche. It's yep. It's gotten to the point where it's almost really, you could use that in a film to mock that style.
Right.
But that happens constantly in this film. And I'm
if it was an SNL skit, you'd be like, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I would get it. I'd be like, yeah, I know. It's so heavy handed. It's ridiculous. Uh-huh. So that happened several times in this film.
Yeah.
And in The Godfather, it makes sense. It's dramatic. It's a one-time deal.
And plus for that character at that moment, that's the perfect culmination of his journey. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is different.
He becomes a godfather and he becomes a godfather
exactly.
at exactly the same time. Right. It makes total sense. It's not.
Yeah.
It's super calculated. It shows his brilliance. And then he also has an alibi because that's where he was.
Yep.
In front of all these people.
But I agree. So this felt a little bit
But intuitive. It shows his qualifications to be the godfather.
Yeah.
in this, it's like the sacraments are so sporadic that it just feels like...
You get the violence, and then they're all in the room saying amen. It's like, okay, you know, we get it.
Yeah, or
it's
they're like...
What a contrast.
They're having communion in prison, and like they're just happen to be eating grape, you know, doing grape juice and...
and bread.
You know, and bread.
Yeah.
But there were several times where there was a church, like a church service, and then violence contrasted immediately.
Yeah.
And that's...
I'm with you.
It just seems cliche.
All right, man. Let's dive into the meat and potatoes here. So what theme stood out to you as you were watching The Irishman? Were there any deep sea of meaning?
Well, I was thinking about the idea of regret is really big in this film. And the idea of that there might be key moments in our lives that we will have a that we will regret for the rest of our lives that we didn't do something differently. And it's a, I think it's common to all human beings. So if I could do this again, I would have done it this way.
That's scary.
Yeah. What regret is?
Well, like imagining making a choice that could affect the rest of your life to the point where you regret it when you're older. Yeah.
Well, I think that's like a sign that you are older. And it's also to me like a sign of that you're becoming a mature human being is that you have regret.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not always like up and to the right. No, I screwed this up and I would give it a lot to redo this, but I know I cannot.
Yeah.
So it's a form of, it's like a form of grief and shame combined almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see regret as being really big here. I see the idea, the Hoffa character is like a Christ character.
Really?
Oh yeah.
How do you figure?
Because he says exactly, he tells the truth all the time.
And
over he says, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say. You can't shut me up. And he says, I don't care if, you know, this is my union. I care about these people. This is my union. And I'm not going to turn my back on it. And I'm going to get it back out of the hands of the people who have corrupted it. And I'm going to get it back out of these folks. And I would never. And so you get this character who is like breaking all these rules. But at the end, there's some kind of deep loyalty that and that he won't sell out.
That's interesting because I took it that it was like a power grab, that he was obsessed with power when he kept talking about my union. But if you think, I see what you're saying. If you think about it, like he's literally looking out for the little people, for these unions, then like, yeah. And he's willing to do whatever it takes, even to the point of crossing the line to get it done. So you, I guess I thought that it was just, he was obsessed with being in control. And
well, I mean, he's being used. They're kind of like shoehorning him into this Christ character. But the idea is that he won't compromise who he is, even when he knows it might mean death.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't compromise. He's going to go, no, this is important that the union exists. This is important that, which kind of takes us a little bit back to, what's the movie that you and Dan hated that I made you watch?
What was it? Oh, that.
On the Waterfront.
I didn't hate it. I just
On the Waterfront is like, you know, that's a movie about like the union too, right?
That's right. The unions.
Yeah, and is a regular man going to get a fair shake? Are they going to, or is there going to be someone that's always trying to skim off of that or redirect the because that's the issue, is they were taking all the pension money and the mob was threatening the Teamster head, and he said no, you can't have everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the threat to the mob. Is that he wouldn't give them everything they wanted, because he said no, I gotta look out for the, you know. And now Hoffa is, you know, obviously not he's a complex character, he's not all good or all bad or whatever,
right.
But in this film, like, that was their big conversation when they're in prison together on, I forgot what their charges were, but they're in prison and they're having their grape juice, they're having communion basically.
Yep.
And they go, you know, he was a good man. You know, we ever think what would have happened? He's like, it was us or him.
Yeah, that's right.
It was us or him, and we did what we had to do. But the regret is maybe we shouldn't, you know.
And you can feel that they both feel that.
They both regret that they killed him.
Yep.
Because they knew, even if, you know, and it might have been, you know, it could have been their lives, but they might have made them wrong. It sounds like they feel like regret, like they made the wrong decision.
And that whole last hour, that's what's so remarkable about it, is like that whole last hour is regret. You know, you see De Niro, like you were saying, getting helpless in this nursing home. And to me, it reminded me that, like, you're going to get to the end of your life and you're going to realize that there were actually only a few things that really mattered. you know, for, you know, it's basically going to be like how you treated the ones you loved, how you treated people around you, and then like what you did, you know, for God, for the kingdom, you know, for something beyond this life. And that's it. That's all that's going to matter. And yet for 2.5 hours, we're just like, everyone's busy doing something, right? Like Frank Hoffa's yelling and blah, blah, blah. And De Niro's doing this and that. And Joe Pesci's giving orders. And then you get to the end and it's just like, there's only a couple things that actually mattered. And that's all, it's all gone. It's all over.
And it's, yeah, at the end of the film, like the door is left open.
Yep.
And is that for, does he know somebody's trying to kill him? Nope.
They're all dead.
They're all dead.
Right.
So is he hoping to get a visit from one of his kids? And mm-hmm. so he still has that hope.
And I like that scene with the picture, you know, where like with the old pictures or something. And that nurse who's just like, you know, some millennial or whatever is like,
I don't know who that is.
I don't know who that is. It doesn't care at all. And yet this is his whole life was that.
Right.
Yeah.
The regret theme is big. And then the thing that we make these trades that we think are going to benefit the people we love. And then in the end, they may push them away.
Mm-hmm. Because he would say that he did everything for the sake of his family, and his family basically would say that he was a monster. So yeah,
and even like Hoffa's kids there when he's, you know, he's loyal to the end, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, in the courtroom and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Tim. Well, what are your final thoughts on The Irishman? Go.
I thought it was okay. It was kind of a mediocre film for me.
Okay.
I thought it could have used some more editing. This is going to stress the point that I didn't watch the film because I didn't see it in a movie theater.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the real point, is that this film would have a lot more power in it on a big screen. Was it even available to watch on a big screen?
Limited time. Like the Oriental showed it for like a week. Yeah.
So not enough for like a human to get to it.
Right.
Maybe if you're like a movie reviewer, yeah, you know, exactly. Like with a paycheck. Yeah. But yeah. Not for a regular person.
Yeah.
That's a bummer for me.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me. I'm like, well, I saw a Netflix movie, but I don't really know if this was, you know,
yeah,
what it was. I think it's interesting and it holds your attention for the whole 3.5. So that just that alone, I would say, like, gives it a B.
It's hard to do. Yeah.
And then the thematic, like the regret thematic stuff to me, I've been given a lot of B pluses, and that's really where I see maybe an A minus on this film, mm-hmm. A minus, B plus. And I would like to see it in the theater, and maybe I would go up from there or down from there based on what I see.
I'm going to give it an A minus. I think that's right. It's definitely one of Scorsese's better mob movies. There's so many great actors, and I do feel like it needs some editing. It's about a half hour too long. It could use some better pacing, especially in the middle. But on the other hand, you can make an argument that running time is what makes it powerful, that when you get to the end and everything comes to a screeching halt, the fact that you spent that long doing, you know, it kind of does add to the power of the ending.
Is it a better movie than Joker?
Oh, no.
Why?
I think Joker's better paced. It's got a performance that outmatches anything in this from Joaquin Phoenix. And so, yeah, I would say Joker's a better film overall.
Like every part of it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the even from what I've seen, all the Netflixiness of it, I feel like the actual directing is better in this film. But that Joker, like the performance is way better in Joker.
Absolutely. It's one for the ages, yeah. But and I do think that, you know, someone made a joke on Twitter that The Irishman is like Goodfellas but with all the driving included in, which I think which I think is funny, but I don't think it's entirely accurate. I mean, the thing that makes Goodfellas for me way better than The Irishman is there's just so many memorable moments that, like, I will remember forever. You know, like Ray Liotta beating up that guy in the beginning, you know, just keeps pounding on him, and the slow-mo shots of, like, Joe Pesci killing Samuel Jackson, and the whole, like, am I funny? Do I amuse you at the club? There's just so many great moments that you're just, like, iconic. You know, these scenes are, like, classic.
It's the lighting looks... I mean, I feel like the lighting and the shooting that film, it's more stylistic.
Yeah.
And then also it's believable, like the ages of people are believable. So yes. I don't have to like jump some kind of hurdle to like, okay, I'm going to suspend all my belief.
Yeah.
And then I think those actors are all at their best.
Totally.
In that time period. Yep. Like even, and that the Ray Liotta character is so necessary for the Pesci character.
Mm-hmm.
And that era of Ray Liotta.
Yep.
You don't want Ray Liotta now.
So yeah, A- for me. It's definitely in my top 10 of the year, but and I think it's one of Scorsese's best mob movies, but yeah, it's in the latter half of my top 10. So yeah, there you go.
Did anybody say it's derivative?
I have not heard that criticism.
People like saying stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. There's always someone who says...
See, when I say it, it's derivative of people that say derivative.
Nice.
So I'm like twice distilled or whatever.
Yeah. No, there's always one person that thinks any movie's derivative.
Well, because from the other stuff or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. I have not heard that, though. And I wouldn't say it is. Although, I mean, if you talk about that christening and the... that's derivative.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there you go, man. The movie is The Irishman, and it is playing at a Netflix near you. So stream it. Do it right now.
On a really small screen. Maybe your phone or like a...
I do remember Scorsese did say, please do not watch this on your phone, which is fair.
You can watch it on one of those LG refrigerator TVs.
Yeah. But nowadays, I mean, you can throw your phone onto your TV. It's not the technology's there, so I don't know. I feel like you can get a pretty close theater experience if you have the right hookup, but I know what you're saying.
It's not right.
Okay. It's fine. So, but hey, next month there is, and it's actually already on Netflix, there is another Netflix movie that's getting a ton of awards attention. It's called Marriage Story. I talked about it before. It's got Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson. I really want to see it.
Do we have
to? Dude, listen, it's up for 6 Golden Globes. It's going to be a Super Awards contender. We got to see it. And it's on Netflix again.
Sounds so depressing.
But I know. It's going to be depressing. But this one, I think, is going to play better on Netflix because it's not that kind of rich sort of visual movie. It's just a drama. So I think this is going to... You're not going to feel like the same, like you watched a totally different movie, hopefully.
No, that's good.
But it'll be there. It's more convenient. It'll be there for us. I think we do need to do it. So
plus,
I think
Kylo Ren's in this.
Kylo Ren, yeah. I think that's going to be next month if you're up for it. So Marriage Story next month. And as always, if you haven't, please take a second to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. We still do not have a new review from the last one that we had over a year ago. Please, our dear listeners, we need you. We need more ratings and reviews. Please take the time to do that. It helps us so much.
We
and again, we will read your review on the air.
We've lost all dignity.
We will resort to shameless begging. That's right. And I hope everyone has a wonderful Christmas out there. You know, as we get to the end of the year, we just want to say thank you so much that so many of you listen to us and that you care what we have to think every month. And it's really an honor to put this out there and have people listen to it.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
You guys should take yourself and a loved one and go to your local theater during the break because you might have a day off here and there.
Yep.
And you should spend a whole... This is something I think would be wonderful. Spend a whole day at the theater. And just see movie after movie after movie.
It's my dream.
Come home all popcorn hungover. Come home and just know that you did that. Maybe make it your tradition, like on the day after Christmas or something, that you go and you go to that theater and you spend a day in the theater. Because I think that's something that would be great and it will support your local theater.
A lot of people do that on Christmas Day. When I worked in a theater outside of college, I was really surprised that a lot of people's Christmas tradition is to go see movies, with their family, which makes sense. But I agree. See 3 movies in a row.
Don't make it special. Don't just sit in your on your phone or like in your front room watching Netflix. Go to a theater and spend the day there and enjoy that whole feel of the place.
That is the one thing I will agree with Scorsese is that I would never want to lose the magic of the theater experience because I like the convenience of watching things on my laptop, but there is nothing like watching a movie with a crowd full of people and you feel the energy. You feel it. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Merry Christmas, Tim, Merry Christmas, a Happy John. New Year. I can't believe it. Our next podcast will be in 2020. We'll be in it. I love you, man. Always grateful to do this with you every month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So keep the faith, my friends, and we will see you next year.